Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of March 12th, 2018. On this week's show, we'll be joined by Slate's Ben Mathis-Lilly to discuss how to maximize your enjoyment of the NCAA tournament during a period in world history when enjoying the NCAA tournament seems kind of hypocritical. But don't worry, we'll figure it out together. Our colleague Jim Newell will also be here to talk about Tiger Woods' almost triumphant return to professional golf. And ESPN's Kevin Arnovitz will help us assess the Raptors and the Rockets, who, go figure, are the teams with the best records in the NBA's Eastern and Western conferences. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan. It's good to be back together.
I know. That was the first time ever that Hang Up and Listen was hosted by someone other than you, me, or Mike Pesca, in case you've forgotten him.
I've been storing up my takes, so I've got at least four this week, as opposed to my usual zero.
Really? If you take 1 week off, you multiply your takes by an infinite number?
It's exponential. Exponential take multiplication. Let us start with the NCAA tournament. I'm always excited for March basketball. You got the CBI, which I'm excited about. Some of the best individual sports moments of my lifetime are March Madness moments. The whole framework of the tournament is fantastic. Lots of games at the same time. They're all on TV for watching by me. But the NCAA basketball tournament is also a very bad thing because it's the very goodness of the tournament that allows the very badness of big-time college sports to exist. Between 2010 and 2032, CBS and Turner are paying $19.6 billion to televise these games because you and I like to watch these games. If we didn't watch, then this rotten system in which some of these billions are going to the players in the form of scholarships, but none of the billions are going to the players in the form of cash money, the system would have to change. But also, if we didn't watch, then we wouldn't get to see awesome buzzer beaters, and I deserve awesome buzzer beaters after all I've been through. Joining us now is our chief hypocrisy correspondent, Ben Mathis-Lilly, who will throw his whole entertainment system in the ocean as a symbolic rejection of everything the NCAA stands for, and will then jump in the ocean to watch Michigan's first round game against Montana at 9:50 p.m. Eastern on Thursday night. Hello, Ben.
It's a complicated plan, but I'm committed to it.
Good thing Ben has the waterproof TV.
The scuba gear has been rented. John Beilein endorsed approach to watching the first round of the NCAA tournament. Ben, as you noted in a piece we published on Slate on Sunday, the recent FBI investigation into players getting paid under the table has been kind of a precipitating event broadly for people like LeBron James, people like NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, people like Barack Obama to say that the NCAA system is not sustainable, that amateurism is broken. But I kind of call bullshit on that, because as long as we continue to watch the tournament, as long as the tournament continues to be such an amazing and successful product, I think the NCAA tournament is sustainable. Is that the right or wrong way to think about this?
I think that's the right way to think about it. I mean, I'm guessing that Barack Obama, who famously filled out March Madness bracket, I think every year he was president with on ESPN, is going to be watching the tournament. I would guess LeBron James, big basketball fan, is probably going to catch it, and I'm pretty sure Adam Silver is going to probably check out a lot of the players who are going to be in his league next year. So am I, having been the one who wrote that article, and so are you guys. So I think you're right. All of us, you, me, Stefan, LeBron, our peer group, we may agree this is not a sustainable model. It's not a fair model, but we are going to support it. We're going to support it by watching the games. I went to a Big Ten tournament game, paid for my tickets in the lead up to March Madness. You know, I have my Michigan gear, and I'll be watching, you know, on TV and online. So it's all, that's all funneling back to the NCAA executives and ESPN and CBS, ESPN and CBS, I guess, for March Madness, CBS, TBS. So it's all going to them, and it's not going to the players.
I want to call bullshit even further. I think that President Barack Obama was fully aware that players were receiving some sort of extrajudicial payment while
extrajudicial.
He was filling out his bracket on ESPN. This is no shock to anybody. And then this is the weirdest part of the last 2 weeks or months with this FBI thing. It's that nothing has changed here. It's not like suddenly Adidas realized that, oh, if we can pay some of these kids, we'll have a better chance of signing them if they become superstars when it's time for them to go to the NBA. And it's not like Andy Miller Sports Agency realized, had the light bulb went off and discovered that if we can find a way to funnel some money to a few kids, we'll have a better chance of signing them when they're ready to declare for the draft. So this is all bullshit. This whole conversation is bullshit. We have been aware of the hypocrisy of rooting for our schools and watching this tournament since this tournament was created almost.
Well, I would go even further than you're going further, sir. It's not only that nothing has changed as far as what's going on. It's that
it's worse.
We're pretending that we're like more interested or more engaged in the fact that these payments are going on. But like everything in the world, a thing is a big story for a day, and then we forget about it. Like the story about that ESPN had that has now been called into question about Sean Miller, the Arizona coach, being caught on an FBI wiretap saying he was going to pay $100,000 for DeAndre Ayton to secure him coming to Arizona, DeAndre Ayton being the best player in college basketball, probably the number one pick in the NBA draft, and a guy who could conceivably lead Arizona to a national championship. You know, the day that that story comes out, you have people like, you know, Jay Billis and others on ESPN essentially saying that Arizona is going to be like nuked into another planet, that Sean Miller is never going to work again, that Arizona is never going to make the tournament. And now here we are 2 weeks later, they're in the tournament.
Hey, they shouldn't have been a four seed. They should have been on the 2 or 3 line, guys.
I mean, I guess, Ben, that would be different if we actually had Sean Miller on the wiretap and we are listening to it. It's like anything else. If there's like video or audio evidence, right, it totally changes it. But it's remarkable to me how quickly that story, which was going to change everything, went to changing nothing. It was like within 72 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was in a CBS article I was reading. It could have been somewhere else, but I think it was a CBS sports article by Matt Norlander. Someone pointing out how many schools, I think Michigan State with Miles Bridges, Arizona with Ayton, and several others whose players were named in one of the big Yahoo or ESPN reports, within a day claimed to have thoroughly researched their eligibility and completely cleared them, I have no problem with these players playing. I don't want them suspended. But the idea that there really was a thorough investigation that, you know, they tracked down all the documents and interviewed the witnesses and they happened to do it, you know, in you know what, 10 hours, just to make sure these guys were eligible. I mean, it's insane. It's ridiculous. But it worked, you know.
It's like,
I mean,
three-dimensional kabuki. Like, everyone is pretending to do stuff and no one's doing anything.
Right.
At least, you know, you sort of took a shot at Jay Billis a little earlier, but at least Jay Billis speaks out against this system.
It's true.
Jay Billis says that it's corrupt and it's a fraud and we should pay the players.
Wait,
and at
least Jay Billis.
But wait, the thing I love about Jay Billis, I was watching some of the ESPN coverage yesterday, is he's like equally outraged about everything
yes.
that happens in the world. Like, he's correctly outraged about the NCAA, but he's like also outraged about the committee. Like, you know, if you're going to try to send a message, if you're not going to pick people based on their resume, if you're going to do it to send a message, I'm like, whoa, Jay Billis is like a very performatively angry person, but I respect
him. He's a man of conviction.
But there are actual real tournament, I was going to say real world, but it's really real tournament impacts to, from the FBI investigation. Louisville, USC, Oklahoma State, we're not selected. Oh my God. Is there a conspiracy here? Were they left out? Does that even matter? I mean, who gives a shit if Louisville's like not in the tournament?
Well, that seems like bullshit.
It seems like a little bit of bullshit, but Louisville's head coach is saying that, you know, we should be in. And then so the LA Daily News reported that two coaches believe that USC didn't get in because of the FBI investigation.
That's I don't buy that. Well, if you look at bracketmatrix.com, which I do, which is the wisdom of the crowds bracketology site that lists, like, you know, everyone who fills out a prediction, Louisville and Oklahoma State were both like way out. Like, there was no sense among the crowd that they were going to get in. USC was like one of the very last teams that was going to be selected, but it's like entirely logical that they didn't make it. I think the only team they beat all year that's in the tournament is New Mexico State. I could be getting that wrong, but I think I saw that somewhere. But I do like this as the like convergence of the like Jay Billis equally outraged about everything. Like, this is the one spot in the Venn diagram, yes, where it's like where the like Jay Billis like corkboard with the strings kind of comes together.
The conspiracy against Louisville apparently started at the start of the conference schedule, forcing them to not have a winning record in the conference.
Yeah, forcing them to lose to Virginia by 17.
It was a deep conspiracy
in the ACC tournament. Yeah.
So my annual plea to the committee, where I get equally outraged about them leaving St. Mary's out as I do about the players not being paid, is that for all of the like analytical discussion, and I'm usually like Mr. Analytics are good.
Around that's what we call like you.
That is what it's a very catchy nickname. You know, I understand that a team like Oklahoma plays a really strong schedule and has like strong schedule strength and RPI and whatever other metrics because of that. But I think the argument to put in teams like St. Mary's and Middle Tennessee that don't play these strong schedules is that we don't know how good they are. And the tournament is, on some level, you know, the goal of it is to determine who the best team in the country is or who the best four teams in the country are. And we know that Oklahoma and these other teams that have losing conference records, I think we know with certainty that they're not going to make it all that far in the tournament because they've played tournament-level teams and just continually and repeatedly lost to them. Whereas with somebody like St. Mary's, who has the ability to beat Gonzaga but just hasn't played that many other teams, like maybe they could make it to the Final Four. We just don't know. And it seems like it would be more interesting to find out how good a team like that is versus just watching Oklahoma lose again.
And it also makes us feel a little bit better, too, because I can see rooting for St. Mary's and not thinking about the FBI investigation.
Oh, come on. That is so you just ruined my good point. I'll let you continue.
St. Mary's could be just as dirty as anyone else.
I was being facetious.
They get all their players from Australia, which is a former penal colony.
Facetious. But there is that feeling of, look, when we start rooting for mid-majors or non-popular teams, or we bring up the conspiracy that Syracuse shouldn't be in, but some mid-major should, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the big programs that generate the most revenue, and therefore we feel the worst about. We know that they are engaging in worse behavior. Whether St. Mary's is or isn't is beside the point. We look at the
name. You probably make more money if you go to Arizona than if you go to St. Mary's. Like, if you're DeAndre Ayton, it's like going to Arizona is better for you.
Agreed. He should go to Arizona. $100,000 is like one-tenth of what he probably deserved.
Do you have any actual basketball-related takes, Ben, that you want to share with us?
Oh, I mean, do you want me to talk about how Michigan should have had the 2 seed in Detroit instead of Michigan State after a 2-0 record this season against Michigan State, 2 double-digit victories?
I hesitate to say, but
that was too open-ended a question for him.
I think we should probably rotate to Stefan and the Penn Quakers, because
if any team in this tournament has a beef about their seeding, it's Penn.
Well, I think of our kind of personal rooting interests here, Stefan's has more of a national flavor, because the fact that Penn was underseeded, which everyone seems to agree on and is a 16 seed, means that we have the best chance, I think, maybe in decades, maybe ever, to have a 16 beat a 1.
In the men's tournament. It's happened in the men's tournament once.
Yeah, the Harvard over Stanford.
I think I saw that if you go by the KenPom rating, since those have been available, it is the best matchup.
Yeah, Penn was ranked 127 in KenPom. All the 16s, 3 15s, and a 14 had lower KenPom rankings than the Quakers. They're even like in the RPI, which we all hate, they were like 109 or something. So it makes no sense. And in the 1 to 68 ranking that the NCAA committee did, they were 64th. So one game from having to play in a play-in. The Quakers were 23-8. They went 12-2 in the Ivy League. They won their little mini tournament. Yeah, they did it at home at the Palestra, but where are you going to play the Ivy League tournament? You're going to play it in the Palestra. And they're not bad. I mean, they're not going to – they probably wouldn't win as a 13 or a 14 either. And in some ways, you could argue that, yeah, there's now some legitimate excitement if Penn can prevent Kansas from showing up, or at least prevent them from shooting a lot of threes, which Penn is pretty good at doing, and Penn can make a lot of threes, which they're pretty good at doing. It could be close. And Ivy League teams have traditionally played close games in the majority of NCAA games.
I love how this is entirely Penn-focused. I think if a number one seed is going to go down, that number one seed has to be like not historically great and not have a good game. And I think Kansas fits in both of those categories. I mean, Oklahoma State, who did not have a particularly good year, like their entire at-large candidacy, this being a team that didn't make the tournament, was based on the fact that they beat Kansas twice. Kansas also lost to Washington. I mean, this is a very weak resume for a team with a number one seed. Like, Kansas seems to have some sort of mind trick that they are able to play on the Big 12 every year, where they just never lose that conference. But this is not a historically a very talented Kansas team. And so I think that's a big reason why this upset could happen. It's 11% chance, according to Ken Pomeroy, which is really high for...
Wow, you know, it's usually
around like 1% for a 16.
We have guaranteed, however, by talking about it, that Kansas will have about a 45-point lead in the first 10 minutes by hyping it up.
That's also possible.
So... maybe DeAndre Ayton is the place to end the conversation. He and Trae Young of Oklahoma did make it, so I'll be excited to watch him. Are probably the players who are going to be the most fun and interesting to watch. I guess Duke has Marvin Bagley as well, Michigan State with Miles Bridges. But I think Ayton is just this like fascinating character as like kind of has three characteristics, like best player in the tournament, probably going to be the number one pick in the NBA draft, and best player and number one pick aren't always the same. And also has come to like symbolize this, this moment in college basketball where the entire model is in question. Like, this is a lot for one player to like symbolize, but he's a very large human being. So I think he can handle it.
I mean, it would be, if you want to talk about heightening the contradictions that could possibly lead to the collapse of the amateurism model, Ayton hoisting the trophy would be about as good as it gets after what's happened.
Oh, and so now let's bring it full circle to your piece, Ben, and how it becomes okay to watch the tournament and care about it. I think that's what you want to root for. I mean, if you are a sentient NCAA hater and you believe that the amateurism model is a sham, then you should want Sean Miller and DeAndre Ayton standing up there shaking Jim Nance's hand and being showered in confetti.
Right. We should say probably that they both deny that they participated in this, what was reported by ESPN.
Well, good being a journalist,
a journalist. But what we should then really hope for is that they're standing up there being showered by confetti and they, in unison, say, "We did it.
We did it."
Freighted with double meaning. I mean, just last thought is that, you know, back to the idea that nothing changes, Shabazz Napier, when UConn won the championship saying in front of an audience of millions that, you know, he didn't have enough money to eat, you would think that that would have changed minds or would have changed behavior.
Well, it did lead to them giving them a larger meal stipend.
I mean, it just went away. Like, people forget that happened. And to the extent that change happened, it was very minor change within the system. Like, the system always wins. Ben Mathis Lilly, thank you for propping up the system for
my pleasure.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we get to Tiger Woods, I want to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, I'm going to talk to Stefan about the greatest triumph of his Scrabble career, his recent victory over two-time national champ David Gibson. If you want to hear about Stefan's tile-based glory, join Slate Plus. Just $35 a year. If you do, you can get bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. Sign up at slate.com/hangupplus.
After Tiger Woods blew another birdie opportunity on Sunday at the Valspar Championship in Florida, I had to look up Valspar. So I guess that was money well spent by Valspar. I emailed Josh and our next guest, Slate golf guy Jim Newell, the following. He's putting like shit. A few minutes later, this happened.
Are you serious? Are you serious?
There's a little of that old Tiger magic.
And a little rabbit out of the hat, Raj.
Yeah. Nice little smile.
A wry little smile there.
This crowd has been like a volcano waiting to erupt.
Like a volcano waiting to erupt. Yes, that was some asshole shouting Baba Booey as Tiger Woods drained a 44-foot putt on the 17th hole to pull within one stroke of the lead. It was not meant to be. Woods finished one stroke behind the winner, Paul Casey, but Tiger's back! And I don't just mean the four surgeries and fused bones. Jim Newell, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
Tiger's 42 years old. He certainly looks like it. That's a big-ass bald spot on the back of his head. And he's been boy who cried wolfing about how it's a process and he's making progress for what seems like years now. I guess it doesn't seem like years because it is years. So here's the question America wants answered by you, Jim. Is Tiger Woods actually back?
Yes. He was he got second place in a tournament. I mean, as long...
That's what we're playing for, is the second place trophy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the best... I think that's the best finish he's had in 5 years. The last time he was anywhere close to contention, before the Honda Classic, which was 2 weeks ago, it was in August of 2015 at the Wyndham, where he finished at 10th place or something. And that's the last time people remember him really being in contention on a Sunday.
And so this wasn't a false flag, is what you're saying?
No. I mean, the thing is, he just hasn't been healthy for more than 3 weeks at a time since then. So, you know, you look at his, like, he had an aborted comeback at the end of 2015, 2016. You know, he played in a couple tournaments before his back started acting up again. So he really, I mean, he does get made fun of so much for, you know, the process and getting in reps and getting his feels back, as he likes to say.
I have a quick note on that.
Yeah.
The reason that I think the Tiger is back is that when he's during all of these like fake comebacks and when he's not playing really well, the way that he would assess his play, he would use all these like fake words that don't even exist. He would talk about like, oh, it's like the grain. All the grains were wrong, or it's like my trage is off. And
yeah.
Like, After this round, he just like sounded like a normal person. Awesome. He was just like, yeah, I was just a little off today. Like, he didn't need to develop a new vocabulary to explain why he sucked. It was just like, yeah, well, my irons were a little off.
He was getting very golfy. I mean, his trage was back, by the way. The trage on some of those shots was amazing. Those little low risers that then just like stop on a dime on the green.
Trage. Great trage. Yeah.
Trage is a good word. No, the trage was awesome. I'm going to add to the dictionary.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at all of the like advanced fancy golf nerd stats, which I'm sure Jim does, Justin Ray of the Golf Channel noted that there are only four players on the tour this year that are in the top 30 in strokes gained tee to green and strokes gained putting, which basically is like golfers that are good at like getting into the green and good at putting. And the people that are good at both those things this year are Dustin Johnson, Phil Mickelson, Tiger Woods, and some guy I haven't heard of. Yeah, Alex Noren.
I think he's 11th now. He has enough stats on the year now to finally be included in the, you know, PGA Tour wide stats. I think he's 11th in strokes gained total. And that's with some pretty terrible driving. So every other aspect of the game must be pretty sharp to make up for it. And I think his driving was actually pretty okay at the Valspar. I think he was in the top 20. And if he's in the top 20, then he's going to be in the top 5 of a tournament probably, just because everything else is so sharp. But, I mean, it just shows that if you can stay healthy for longer than, you know, a few weeks at a time, he can get back to it. It's just a matter – hopefully he will stay healthy now and that fuse back, you know, is durable enough.
I can see that you're just, like, getting really worried. Like, you're
– I know. I'm so worried.
The tone of your voice there just got a little dark there for a second. So, Stefan, the thing that I found really upsetting about the way that NBC broadcast the tournament is that Brant Snedeker was partnered with Tiger and just did – he was awful. But
had a bad day.
As soon as a guy does really badly and falls off the leaderboard, they just, like, exile him from the broadcast.
It's totally like, you know, a Kremlin photo from the Soviet era. He is out. He's airbrushed.
But the thing is, like, it seemed like Tiger was, like, doing really badly just because he couldn't make these putts. But he's, like, doing really well compared to Brant Snedeker. Like, I feel like you need the, like, the guy having the, like, super shitty day to remind the viewer of, like, what bad really looks like. Like that was, like, a totally, like, decent round by Tiger. He just didn't putt well.
Yeah, but the bad has to be – it's got to be really bad for you to want to watch it. You know, and that's why I had suggested that there should be kind of a red zone channel for bad golf. Somebody throws one in the creek. We're cutting right to that shot show in the replay, watching him take off his shoes and get down in there to get the ball out.
I mean, it was really funny to watch the beginning of the coverage on Sunday, because for the first three rounds, this guy, Corey Connors, who is, you know, no one's ever heard of him before, he was leading the tournament. And people expected him to fade on Sunday, but he made a bogey on hole number one. And you could see the TV producers like, great, we do not ever have to show this guy again.
But he got back into it, right?
He like,
because when he got back, he got back to like 8 under and to tie Woods. And it was like, I hadn't been watching until, you know, until they had made the turn. And it was like, wait, where'd this guy come from? Who's he?
But yeah, I mean, he ended up, you know, having a pretty bad day. Snedeker was, 7 over. And I was really surprised that Justin Rose, who was the best player in the field, I think, and is just, a really excellent player, I was surprised that he fell off towards the end, because I was figuring he was the biggest threat to Tiger and so wanted him to fail, you know, a lot. I was screaming for him to fail at the TV so that he would not be Tiger. And he did fail, but unfortunately Tiger didn't make enough putts.
So you're Tiger rooting here. I mean, is that pure Tiger rooting, or is it like the rest of us – who are like, oh, wait, Tiger Woods is in, you know, at the top of the leaderboard in a golf tournament. I think I will turn that on now. I haven't watched much golf. I'll turn it on because we're talking about it. I'll turn it on for the majors. But I turned on golf yesterday.
I recorded it and just fast forwarded through all the golfers who weren't Tiger.
That's the best way to do it.
That's the way I watch golf.
Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting that, like, if you're rooting for Tiger, it also means like actively rooting against the other players. It makes it more fun.
Yeah. No, I wanted Tiger to win. I've always been a Tiger fan, and now he's back. I want him to win. I mean, I actually am happy. If he wasn't going to win, I'm happy that Paul Casey did win, because he's also a really good player who hasn't gotten a win in a while. But, you know, I mean, it wasn't Tiger's best round, but it wasn't, you know, when you think of a bad Tiger round, like a few weeks ago, a bad Tiger round would have just been like hitting every ball out of bounds. This was sort of a controlled bad round. I mean, this was one of those
frustrating rounds. Like, yeah. It was just his iron shots just weren't close enough to give him a legitimate opportunity to birdie.
Right, but it wasn't
on
a meltdown.
Hole after hole on the back nine. No, it was no meltdown at all. And it does raise the point that, you know, we watched And Tiger makes it compelling. Tiger makes you want to turn on the television. And Tiger on 18 on the green with a chance to tie or win a tournament is still really something to watch.
And yeah. I got to say that putt on 17, like for all the excitement that the broadcaster gave it, that was like a legit awesome sports moment. Like they could have made it like 10 times.
They could have hyped
more.
They,
more
they
hyped.
Waited a long time to for
it
the
was
crowd
incredible.
Noise.
It was incredible.
It was, although it just made me more nervous because I was preparing to, you know, check out for the rest of the day. Like, he wasn't going to win. And then I had to watch on Pins and Needles number 18.
Well, it's the first time you've ever felt alive in your whole life.
So that must have been. That at must least have since been, the last time Tiger was in contention.
That must have been stressful for you. Well, remember, like, there were, like, people with, like, legit takes a few years ago that were not even based around Tiger's health. They were based around he has the yips and can't chip anymore,
right?
And like has no short game, and it seems like that isn't an issue anymore.
Well, there have been so many bad Tiger takes. Like it's all his health. I mean, it started in, you know, after the incident in 2009. You know, when his personal life just like exploded everywhere. Then they didn't.
Oh, you mean when he was like sleeping with?
When he was sleeping with everyone in the country,
And his
remember
wife
that story?
Took a golf club and did something to a car. Or
something? Chased him with a 9-iron.
Oh,
or something
chased him
like
with
that.
A 9. That's right. Yeah, I've forgotten. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I think it's a 9-iron, yeah. Raj. I think it's a 9-iron.
But it, you know, it took him a little while to get back from that. But ever since then, it's only been injuries. Like even the chipping yips, a lot of that was just because he had pain shooting through his leg and he couldn't really get comfortable over the balls. So, I mean, if he's, like, pain-free, then he can probably get over that stuff. But he was over that by 2015, I remember, because he took a few months off to, like, work on his chipping. And he came back at the Masters, and he was fine. So
Tiger hasn't gotten a restraining order out against you or anything, Jim, has he?
No.
Okay. All right. Next week, Bay Hill. He has won this tournament, like, 47 times, I think. So yeah. this could be the moment.
Yeah, he should win it. I mean,
it's a golf tournament. Guy, it's hard to win a golf tournament.
Yeah, no, he's won 8 times. I mean, if he's,
My guy, Justin Ray, noted that Phil Mickelson had gone 1,687 days between wins before he won the other week. And Sunday at Bay Hill will be 1,687 days since Tiger's last victory.
I know. I was really hoping one of the 8 million reasons I was hoping that Tiger would win on Sunday was that he could one-up Phil Mickelson once again, who finally got his attention for coming back and having a great season, and then Tiger would, you know, just win the next week and no one would care about Phil anymore.
I have a couple of golf takes that I've stored up from just not ever watching golf that are not necessarily Tiger-related, but I just have some hot golf opinions.
Jim can make them Tiger-related.
That I wanted,
it's okay.
That I wanted to share. First of all, is there anything more awkward in all of sports television? We like to make fun of the Butler Cabin interview, but what about every week in the golf tournament where they invite the CEO of the company up to the booth and they're always like, man, what a great, isn't this a great field? This, what a great event. What a great tournament. It's like, some people might say that that's bad, but I always look forward to like the awkward rich guy CEO talk. That's golf take number one.
That's a good take.
Number two. I noticed that on the 16th green, the flagstick was an American flag, which led me to wonder, why aren't all flags on flagsticks American flags? What is, like, at the Trump courses, are the flags not American flags? If not, why does Donald Trump not support America?
It's true. I think you're making a good point. I mean, why is golf insufficiently jingoistic here? Mm-hmm.
That's
I
what
mean,
I'm saying.
Why does it have to only be the Ryder Cup?
They don't play the national anthem before
every
putt. The golfers play, yeah. All right, final golf take.
Yeah.
So they were, like, really going hard on, like, there's some stretch at the end of this, like, rando golf course that they're playing the Valspar tournament at.
It's a good golf course, by the way. I've played that course.
All right.
Just getting that in there.
Jim has played it. It's the Copperhead course at Innisbrook. They're calling the, like, tough stretch on this course the Snake Pit. And they have a bronze statue of stakes. I mean,
I have a photo taken with that statue. That's how cool I am.
All right, that's great for you. But like, it seems like they're trying a little bit too hard with the branding there to like push that this thing is the Snake Pit. I mean, that's no Amen Corner.
Right.
I mean,
you got to earn it.
I mean, number 16
saying.
Is
you can't
a really
just call it.
Number 16 is a really hard hole, but 17 and 18 aren't that hard. But 16 is one of the hardest holes on tour.
So basically, they're just giving a name here to make people think that it's really difficult.
Yeah, they're trying to come up with some sort of branding for the Copperhead course.
And I don't know this for a fact. I'm sure Jim just happens to know. But it seems like this is like the classic rule where you're not allowed to nickname yourself. And it just seems like they decided that they were going to name it the Snake Pit. And it just seems lame to like nickname your own stretch of difficult holes.
I think they should have called it the Shark Tank and gotten some cross promotion because it is an NBC property, isn't it?
It is not.
Oh, it is not.
It's ABC.
Shark Tank is ABC. Well, then they couldn't call it the Shark Tank.
No.
Yeah.
Maybe Greg Norman. Yeah. Maybe that could have been a site of one of his famous collapses.
I think they're doing a riff on at where they play the Honda Classic. They have the Bear Trap, which if anyone watched that, they mentioned the words Bear Trap about 8 million times. And those are actually three really tough holes that, in fact, screwed up Tiger Woods' chances at that tournament. But these holes, I mean, aside from 16, it's not the same thing.
So is the new trend to have three holes named? Are we naming holes in threes now?
I'm trying to think.
That's
I guess
Amen Corner.
There's Amen Corner, and then at Quail Hollow, where they play a tournament in May, there's the Green Mile.
The Green Mile?
Yeah, because it's three, another, like,
because that's where people get executed?
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
All right.
They always come up, if they don't make a birdie, they execute them.
I think we've covered it all, Stefan.
I think we have. Jim Newell loves golf, works for Slate. What else do you need? What are the credentials does one need to be on this podcast? Jim, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
On Sunday in the National Basketball Association, the Golden State Warriors, who are playing without Steph Curry, he of the frequently injured ankle, lost by 6 to the Minnesota Timberwolves. Meanwhile, the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Warriors' opponents in the last three NBA finals, looked atrocious defensively and getting blown out by Brooke Lopez, Julius Randle, Isaiah Thomas, and the LA Lakers. And by the way, meanwhile, in other parts of the NBA, the 52-14 Houston Rockets won by 23, and the 49-17 Toronto Raptors won by 26. The teams with the two best point differentials in the NBA played each other on Friday. And not surprisingly, it was a very good and closely contested game, with Toronto winning 108-105 at home on Drake Night to snap Houston's 17-game winning streak. Joining us to talk about whether these contenders are actually contenders is Kevin Arnovitz of ESPN. It's an amazing coincidence because it's actually Kevin Arnovitz Day on the podcast. We're going to have a video tribute for you later, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
A video tribute?
On a podcast, yeah, it's going to be amazing.
It's fantastic.
We've had our best people on it. It's going to knock your socks off.
We are melding media. This is great.
Let's start with the Raptors. They earned it, Kevin, by beating the Rockets the other day. Toronto is a team that seemed destined to always be good but not great. They won 56 games 2 years ago and got absolutely destroyed by the Cavs in the Eastern Conference Finals. Then they won 51 games last year, and they got absolutely destroyed by the Cavs, this time in the conference semis. Their two stars, Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan, are 31 and 28, respectively, on the wrong side of their primes, arguably. They didn't make
arguably. That might be one of the things going on here.
Okay. They didn't make any big offseason acquisitions, and yet it seems like they made a huge leap this year based on improvement by their own players that they've drafted and developed, which is a notion that, to me at least, Kevin, feels extremely quaint in today's NBA.
Yeah. You know, continuity is this often regarded as the mother's milk of the NBA. And what I mean is that basketball, unlike baseball, which is essentially an individual sport, and football, where, you know, it's a quarterback receivers game and you need some blocking, and I don't know enough about football to really expand beyond that. But like, basketball requires this telepathy. When you have five players on the floor, as much defensively as offensively, right? Where it is just kind of player movement within the half court, knowing where your teammates like the ball, when, how, and under what circumstances, knowing your teammates' liabilities defensively so you can send the help defensively when the first defender fails at the assignment, which usually happens in the NBA because it's really hard to guard opposing point guards and opposing big men who can score. And that if you keep a team together long enough, it can kind of marinate and over time perform at its full potential. And we've seen kind of instances of this over the years, right? The Indiana Pacers from a few years ago didn't get to the promised land because of, you know, the Miami Heat's big three assembly, but like, you know, a really good team that really kept the core group together, Paul George and, you know, players, the other players whom were none of who are all-star quality, but that by virtue of just keeping the thing together, and the San Antonio Spurs would be the best example of this, that you can actually have incremental improvement. And when you're a pretty good team, you can get to a very good team, and there's this moment where you become an exceptional team. The Stockton Malone Utah Jazz are a perfect example of this. Those guys actually didn't get to the finals to the very tail end of their careers when they were way past their prime, but they kept the general group together around them, kind of mixed and matched some people, developed some bench talent, scored on a couple of draft picks, and then you eventually can get there. That rather than do this thing where you shuffle the deck and press the button and implode a roster, that you can just kind of stick with it. Improve upon what you have, ditch bad ideas, you know, improve what works. And I think that's what the Raptors essentially have done.
No, I'm not buying it. I mean, it would have been totally logical to think that they had maxed out over the last 2 years. Like, they did keep it together for a long time. And DeRozan and Lowry and the guys around them did meld and play together. And they were a really good, solid regular season team that was defeated brutally by the best player of his generation. And that's what always happens in the NBA.
Which was likely to happen regardless. So if that's the case, look, you can't get past LeBron James with who you've got, as good as DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry had become, then what do you do? The NBA model, Joss, you're asserting, is basically like, you got to do something. You have to like clear some cap space, sign a big name. Instead of have a big two, we have a big three. Now we can compete. But is Toronto's model, Kevin, for lack of trying to do that? Or is it baked into the structure of who that franchise is, baked into the reality of geography and contracts in the NBA?
Yeah. I mean, I think we can kind of suspend the, oh, it's not a market, guys, and go, Chris Bosh doesn't like the bad cable or didn't have the good cable in Toronto. His famous explanation in 2010 of, you know, what was lacking in Toronto. You know, market's becoming a little less important in the league. And I think we're going to see it over time. It'll be really interesting to watch Donovan Mitchell over the next several years. And this idea that a player isn't willing to stick around a, you know, but meanwhile, by the way, Toronto's like the fifth largest market in the league. So this, and I think the notion that it's not cosmopolitan or it doesn't offer anything other than some tax issues.
Right.
But let's move on from there. I mean, I think one of the things happened. One is they draft very well and they develop those players. Fred VanVleet is an undrafted guard who is now their backup point guard, leading the most lethal unit in the league. I think I don't remember the last time I checked, but I think the Toronto bench, as of a couple of weeks ago, and I don't think it's gotten any worse, was I think 32 points per 100 possession better. I don't know what the stat is this morning, but clearly it is still premier.
Let's name those guys. Jakob Poeltl, Pascal Siakam, Fred VanVleet, DeLon Wright, and C.J. Miles.
C.J. Miles.
And that was kind of the point that I was getting at in my intro. It's like, everything that you said is true, Kevin, but they've taken a huge leap this year because of that five-man unit that I mentioned, five guys that maybe if they were in another franchise wouldn't have played so well. Maybe the Raptors have developed them really well. But it's just like, you couldn't have predicted that the internal improvement would have come from like the Jakob Poeltl, Pascal Siakam, Fred VanVleet triad.
Yeah, and there's another thing at work here. And I mean, I think a little credit goes to Raptors 905, which is their G League team. The Raptors kind of build a strategy where let's have our G League minor league team down the street. And we've seen a couple of NBA franchises do this. And what we'll do is, and Jerry Stackhouse actually was the coach for that team. What we'll do is we'll sort of use it as an incubator. We'll run the same sets that we run up in Toronto. We'll develop talent. By the way, guys can practice here and then we can, you know, we can assign them for the night, go down there, play a game, come back, be practicing with the big squad, and essentially use it as kind of the minor league model, not unlike, you know, what baseball's done, except, you know, in the proximity of our own team. And so you have guys like, you know, Siakam, who were drafted, pretty raw talent. needs to, you know, I mean, I think one of the problems that happens with player development in the NBA and why, you know, there's sort of this talent drop off after the first or second tier is that it's always, if you think about any other profession, the 381st best basketball player in the world never plays a live game other than garbage time, right? So you have all these players who never, because, you know, by and large, you want DeMar DeRozan on the floor 34, 35 minutes a night. You want Kyle Lowry on the floor 32 minutes a night. You've signed Serge Ibaka. You're kind of committed to him. So if you're Siakam, sort of the next year model of Serge Ibaka, what are you going to do? And so I think, you know, that was part of it. They kind of built this development structure there, which allowed these guys to get really good. Fred VanVleet was the star of the 905. Well, the logical graduation in previous years would have been, okay, you know, we have a pretty guy who we like in Kyle Lowry who we're committed to, you know, go on your way. Some other team spots him, signs him. Well, now he's sort of absorbed into the Raptors' overall structure. So I think that's been the other thing. And the final thing is I think they stopped playing an intensive brand of isolation basketball.
Here's a way to let's transition to the Rockets here. I mean, Kyle Lowry is playing the fewest minutes per game that he has played since, I think, 2013. And down in Houston, which signed Chris Paul to help complement James Harden in the offseason, he's touching the ball less than obviously he ever has in his career because he's on the same team as James Harden. How have the Rockets, in contrast to the Raptors, made themselves legitimate contenders to dethrone Golden State?
I mean, they've sort of constructed the perfect roster for the system that they employ. Unlike Toronto, they didn't have to kind of conform to anything. I mean, Mike D'Antoni has a very distinct philosophy. I sat with him for about an hour, I think the week before last, and kind of asking him just about general basketball philosophy. And, you know, he's somebody who kind of came into the league, identified a problem, which is teams are overcoached. That this idea that a coach could commandeer from the sideline every single possession, where the choreography, how the choreography is going to operate, who's going to get the ball, where, it is just an antiquated notion that, A, players don't like it. They want to play basketball. I mean, so why not design a system that is fun for them? And that's kind of been the D'Antoni ethic. It does require the same kind of sacrifice because it means that if you're a player who has played for coaches where you know when and how you're going to get your shots exactly, that's a real that's a suspension of trust because it's like, well, when am I going to get my shots? And then there are nights where you stand in the corner, you know, waiting for a 3-point attempt that never comes. But, you know, Harden and Paul really kind of took to it. And they're such great decision makers that you sort of put the ball in their hands. You have some basic principles. It's still functionally a spread pick and roll offense that Mike D'Antoni ran for Steve Nash and Mike D'Antoni, and Amari Stoudemire in Phoenix. But the pieces are a little different.
If you watch the highlights of the Rockets, no team plays more simply and no team scores as easily as they do. And the thing that I find fascinating about them is that if you just thought, if all you knew about Mike D'Antoni was he changed the game when he was the coach of the Suns because they played super fast, you would watch this team and be really confused because the Rockets don't actually play that fast. And they also don't pass the ball. Like, they're second to last in the NBA in passes completed per game. I think it's a testament to D'Antoni that he is able to adjust to his personnel and doesn't just impose his quote-unquote system on these guys. But the way the Rockets play is, I don't know if it's kind of a combination, Kevin, of being like super modern and very antiquated at the same time. They basically play isolation with Harden or Paul and just run pick and rolls and surround them with 3-point shooters.
Right.
It's like super simple.
They're going to they're on pace to attempt more 3-pointers than 2-pointers this season for the first time in NBA history.
They are. That will be the first time in NBA history that the team attempts more threes and more twos. But here's the thing about the passing stat. And I will never, as somebody who loves the continuity offense that San Antonio fashioned, you know, I would never criticize passing. You know, they would tell you, well, if you can find a good shot in two passes, why are you passing it 4 and 5 times?
Sure.
Like, a pass essentially is an expression of failure, right? Like, it's like, okay, we got it to this guy and, well, he's covered. Okay, try this guy.
That's a good line that I think is deeply untrue, but I still like it.
No, that's what I'm saying. And I agree. I mean, I love passing, and I think passing generally finds the open guy. You know, the ball finds energy is what D'Antoni says. So I'm more being contrarian here. Passing is not an expression of it's actually expression of sharing. But my point is, I mean, how many possessions do we see where it's Harden, dribble, screen set, and then what happens? Okay, one pass to Capella, or, oh, wait, you know, Capella's screen is just lethal and all Harden needs is the slightest pocket of space.
Yeah.
Okay, zero passes, or pass to Capella, or, hey, defense collapses, Harden's driving, sees the help coming, one pass to the corner. And so I think, you know, it's funny because I've been, you know, I'm having a lot of fun with this sort of the tracking data. But one of the things I'm noticing is passes aren't necessarily a correlation to efficient offense.
Yeah.
And I think at times in Utah, it works really well, right? Because there isn't a Harden on Utah. I mean, Donovan Mitchell's coming into his own, but he's just not there yet. They require passes, and what they do is they just essentially flip the floor with their passes and are able to manufacture. But, you know, they don't have to manufacture anything in Houston. I mean, they just get it.
I think the thing that we're seeing with the Raptors and the Rockets is both around how you play on the floor and around team building is that there really isn't a single way that you have to do it in the NBA. The notion that you need to go out and sign LeBron or get Durant. You know, the last 3 years, that looked like a really good plan. But I think this year, what we're seeing is that there is value in just trying to win. And there are a lot of teams that aren't trying to do that, both in the short term and the long term. But, like, you know, it is looking like even if, you know, Steph Curry is at peak health, that the Rockets are going to give them like a really tough fight and a really good series. And it looks like, you know, Cleveland is not going to be able to fix their problems. Like if Cleveland makes it to the finals, it seems unlikely that they're going to make it to the finals by just like blitzing the entire Eastern Conference. They haven't played defense all year. So just like by virtue of trying to win and not like being defeated by the fact that LeBron and the Warriors have just like romped through the league the last 3 years. Like that philosophy seems to be paying off pretty well this year.
Yeah. And I mean, the Rockets are pretty open about the fact that they constructed this roster to compete with the Warriors. That was almost the entire objective, that they're not even being coy about it. And, you know, they feel like they now have the, and the defense is a big part of the, part of the success in Houston. I mean, I never thought this would be an 8th, 9th, 10th ranked defense. I just didn't think the personnel was there.
You know, because nobody's really won an NBA championship without a top 10 defense, right?
Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing. I mean, Cleveland a couple of years ago, and it's Cleveland, right? So it's LeBron, which means that you just kind of throw away the regular season ranking and say, okay, once April 14th rolls around, you know, this is a team that's capable of playing a top five brand of defense, which they did. But yeah, defense is essential, and they've even kind of aped the Warriors and defensive strategy, where they've become a switch-oriented team. In fact, I think they switch more often than the Warriors do even now. And the idea is, let's just bank on versatility. Let's have a bunch of guys who can guard a bunch of positions. Luke Bamute, PJ Tucker, Joe Johnson now. You know, let's give our small guys the confidence to know that, hey, look, you know, if you want to post up Chris Paul and you're the big man because you get him on the switch, guess what? 0.81 points per possession. Okay, that's lousy offense. So they've sort of just embraced that. And I mean, look, at the end of the day, I mean, that's what's kind of funny about the Western Conference Finals between the Rockets and the Warriors. It might very well come down to who makes shots. Is it Andre Iguodala and Draymond Green from the perimeter, or Luke Bamute and PJ Tucker? There obviously the stars will get theirs, and there will be, you know, supernova performances that win games in that series, but on its margins, I think that's going to be the game. And both teams have played that way, which is like, show me that your marginal kind of perimeters playing as big men can hit shots.
Kevin Arnovitz is a writer for ESPN, and he thinks passing is bad. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I wanted to do the traditional outro because you deserve that, but we're going to have you stick around for After Balls, and you'll know why in a second. Now it is time for the After Balls, and I'm going to read aloud the lead to a Zach Lowe Grantland story from 2013. It begins, True story. There is an NBA mascot convention every summer where about 24 mascot performers get together, exchange best practices, show off their best highlights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They also give out various awards, sort of a mascot Oscars. For several years, the mascots also created a joke award, the Craptor. It was a plunger painted gold that they awarded to whomever experienced the worst blooper of the season, the worst accidental pratfall, the video skit that flopped, or some other low light the television cameras had caught. Now, I think maybe the inspiration for this was that the best GIF of all time, which is the Raptors inflated mascot rollerblading onto the floor, instantly falling onto its face and then having its tail sadly deflate and have the air go out of it. That was kind of a Craptor moment. But, you know, we talked about the good things with the Raptors, and I think it's only appropriate that we did the Craptor for our afterballs. But so I'm going to go first this week, Stefan.
All right, then let me just say, Josh, what's your Craptor?
All right, Kevin, now you're going to find out why you're here. I'm going to praise a piece that you wrote a couple of years ago. Now, you've written so many good pieces, you're probably wondering what piece of mine is Josh Levine going to lavish praise on right now? Well, you'll find out in a second. As I've taken to watching most sporting events on DVR, my viewing habits have changed. As I talked about earlier in the show, when I watch golf, I just fast forward through everyone who isn't Tiger Woods. It's only sensible. In baseball, I just fast forward through the whole season. No worries. I'll just read about the good stuff later. And in basketball, I sometimes fast forward when guys are taking their time dribbling up the court, but sometimes not. It depends on my mood and how quickly I'm trying to get through the game. But the one thing I will always fast forward through, Kevin, is the first free throw in a 2-free throw sequence. You've got a shooting foul. You've got Harden going to line for two, because there's always a shooting foul with Harden going to the line for two, or sometimes Harden going to line for three. I'm not going to sit there and twiddle my thumbs while my dude gets the ball from the ref and spins the ball and shoots the ball. It's almost certainly going in. And if it doesn't go in, it's not going to miss in an interesting way. There's not going to be a rebound opportunity since it's the first of two free throws. It's 99.9% sure that I'm not going to miss anything interesting, because the only interesting thing that could happen is an air ball on the first of two free throws. And that's like three times a year.
What about the fist bumping
proposition? You know what? I can watch if there's a great fit. If like Kevin Love goes to like high five people and they don't high five him back, I'll watch the GIF later. It's fine. I won't miss anything. In conclusion, the first of two free throws is an extremely skippable sports moment. So how to fix this? Eliminating free throws from basketball. It's not the worst idea in the world. I've thought about it a lot, but it's hard to come up with a plan of how you would eliminate free throws entirely that would be workable. I will let the audience work that out on their own time. We're fast-forwarding through this after ball. I'm a huge fan of a half measure that my very good friend Kevin Arnovitz wrote about in 2014 in a piece for ESPN.com headlined, "Is One Trip to the Free Throw Line Enough?" My answer, Kevin, is an emphatic yes.
And do you want to explain this concept, Josh? It is it's a very easy one.
Yes, the concept was this. I'm going to explain it by just reading from your article. The concept was this. A player fouled in the act of shooting or in a penalty situation would attempt only a single free throw if that player was shooting a two-point shot or in a penalty situation at the time of the foul. The free throw attempt would be worth 2 points. If that player was fouled in the act of launching a three-point shot, he'd go to the line for a single shot worth 3 points. By doing so, and this was as of 2014, we would reduce 47 free throw attempts per game in the NBA to about 26.
It's too bad baseball doesn't have free throws, because that would be an easy way to shorten the game.
So, Kevin, the peg for this was that this was something that allegedly was being considered in what was then known as the NBA D League, the minor league. How seriously was it being considered, actually?
I mean, I think there was a point about 4 or 5 years ago where the D League was truly, hey, let's try anything. As the G League, Gatorade has bought sponsorship. My sense is they've gotten a little more conservative, that they actually see the G League as a product in and of itself, not merely an incubator for, you know, zany NBA reform ideas. So, they've backed off it, is my understanding, because I kind of keep tabs on this one just because I just think it's so patently obvious that it would be a better sport if you could eliminate 26 skills competition attempts you know, of twirling, as you say, and everything else. Like, I mean, that is a lot of time. And I don't know. I don't. I, at some point, I was kind of using a stopwatch. I forget what it was, but I mean, you're talking about a substantial amount of dead time in an NBA game. Now, I kind of proposed this at the Sloan MIT conference, the Sports Analytics conference, a few weeks ago. And, you know, a representative from the league suggested that, hey, look, I think what we'd have to do in the final 2 minutes of a game is we'd have to go back to the more conventional rules, I guess, because the variance, like in terms of teams trying to come back, et cetera, it might eliminate. They kind of have run the numbers and feel like it might eliminate more comeback attempts.
Well, and also the hack a bad shooter would the incentive would only go up, right? I mean, it's one shot, guy makes 50%. You know,
I don't know. I mean, would it go up because then you have one shot to make 2 points rather than
the likelihood of him making one and getting the 2 points versus making both.
Well, what it does, it's like the same thing as shooting threes. It like increases variance. So the most common outcome when you hack a 50% free throw shooter is 1 point. In this scenario, it would average out to being 1 point, sure. But it would be zero or two.
Right.
And so you noted in your piece, Kevin, one interesting effect of this is that, if you're a 75% free throw shooter, we would still in the system preserve and ones. And so there would be certain free throws that would be worth 1 point. And so you could be a 75% free throw shooter, but not score 75% of the possible points if you happen to make more 1 point free throws or 2 point free throws.
Right. And that's for anything. I mean, problem with HACA, whatever, is that it's just administered incorrectly so often. It's really something you're supposed to do when you're ahead. Right, which is kind of, you know, it's insurance against the big run. And yet it's often administered when teams are behind, where it's a pretty bad strategy.
Kevin, I think this is one of those ideas where, there's a thing in the basketball tournament about like the Elam ending and like capping the score. And that's like a really cool idea that's just like not going to happen probably. But this is an idea that's like both innovative, but I think could theoretically happen and would just be really good for fans and for the league. And so you need to keep pushing for this, man.
I don't think it's all that radical.
It isn't.
It doesn't change anything about the scoring system. It doesn't. The fundamental shot is the same. I think here's how I think it maybe comes to fruition. With the sort of attention span of Generation Z or whatever the next thing goes, I think we're going to get to a point where productions of any kind that are 2 hours and 20 minutes, be they motion pictures, be they sporting events, like we might get to a point where NBA down the road another decade or so starts experiencing the same paranoia baseball does of we just have to shorten these games. And it is just an easy 10 minutes. Like it is the easiest 10 minutes. Every ball is live. And it's not just the time saved. It's the idea that if you look away, you're
cutting
not
out
winning.
The right
it's
10 minutes.
It's your initial point, right, Josh, which is if I look away now, I'm not going to miss anything. The idea is to create entertainment where if I look away for a moment, I might miss something. I mean, that's going to be the entire ethic of entertainment. And so, okay, that becomes an easy reform to ensure that you don't have that dead time where I look away, I don't miss anything.
Could players argue, though, that foul shots actually give them a blow, it give them a rest and make them better
yes.
players down the for the rest of the game?
To me, that's actually the best case for it, against it, which is that, hey, Kevin, you're always talking about rest and recovery and we need to preserve energy. And these guys should be at peak performance in the fourth quarter of important games, that those moments actually serve as sort of the rest in your interval workout.
Thank you, Kevin. Good idea.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Stefan, what is your crapter?
Before 9/11, when I lived in New York, I worked for the Wall Street Journal across the street from the World Trade Center. At lunch, sometimes I would walk a couple of blocks to one of those little New York spaces with a few trees and some benches and tables that get to be called parks, and I would play backgammon. The Chess Hustlers were farther north in Washington Square Park, where I also cut my teeth at Scrabble. Backgammon had a lock on this little patch of blacktop in Lower Manhattan. I considered and still consider myself a good casual player. I played a ton of backgammon as a kid in the summer in Greece, me against some old dude in a fisherman's cap at a sidewalk cafe Neo in the village where my father grew up. I move the checkers intuitively, but unlike in Scrabble, I've never studied backgammon, never learned the probabilities or analyzed positions. In the park, I'd get hustled for 10 bucks at lunch. It was money well spent. I read over the weekend about the death of Paul McGrill, one of the greatest backgammon players of all time, at age 71. Like most board game experts, McGrill was a math genius. His parents were a ballet historian and an architect who socialized with James Agee and Arthur Schlesinger and Eero Saarinen. He grew up on the Upper East Side, attended Dalton and Exeter, and spent summers on Cape Cod, where he went deep-sea fishing with Norman Mailer. McGrill went to NYU and then studied probability as a graduate student at Princeton, and in the 1970s taught math at a college just outside of New York. That's when he started playing backgammon at Manhattan Games Parlors, and eventually he quit teaching. By the late 1970s, McGrill was a backgammon and media celebrity. He wrote a best-selling how-to book and landed a weekly column in the New York Times. He had a nickname bestowed on him, the human computer, and one that he bestowed on himself, X-22, which came from a tournament that he played against himself with 64 imaginary competitors, X-1 through X-64. X-22 was the winner. In 1978, McGrill was hired by a Saudi sheikh to provide a few weeks of personal training and some side games for cash in the kingdom. Backgammon was having such a moment that 60 Minutes did a piece about the game, during which Dan Rather asked McGrill about the Saudi gig.
How did you get into that job?
Well, so I just happened to run into this sheikh at a discotheque, Studio 54 in New York, and I had no idea who he was, and he had no idea who I was. And I played the guy one game, and he said, I want you to come to Saudi Arabia with me, work it out with my, you know, lackey or whatever. So that's where I'm going.
Yes, Josh, a backgammon pro met a Saudi sheikh at Studio 54. I wonder if Pelé and the Cosmos were there too that night. I might have said George Plimpton, but Plimpton had already played a blindfolded McGrill as a promotion for a big tournament. The New Yorker, of course, wrote about it. The piece is filled with dubiously perfect quotations and Plimpton shouting, "À la table!" to announce the match. McGrill won. In 1979, Sports Illustrated profiled McGrill, who was then the world champion. The 8-page feature portrays him, as you might expect, an obsessive brainiac who would spend days alone in his red-walled, television-free Manhattan apartment and then play backgammon for 72 hours straight, or party for days, or take a whirlwind trip to Chicago or Vienna or Los Angeles or Milan to participate in a tournament during which he will talk nonstop and go without sleep. The eccentric games genius is a familiar character to me, and among the games that produce eccentric geniuses, backgammon is the one most like Scrabble. Both contain an element of luck, both are about board position and probability, and both are deceptively complex. Except for the Saudi sheikhs and the upper-class sensibilities and high-stakes events, reading about Paul McGrill was familiar. He articulated what I have felt and what others in Scrabble have articulated so well, the idea of a board game as a refuge, a place governed by rules, of clear right and wrong, where the arbitrariness and bullshit of the real world don't apply. It reminded me of my Scrabble friend Lester Schoenbrunn, whom I wrote about for Slate after his death a few years ago. But what separates the greats like McGrill from patsers like me is the understanding that they possess the knowledge to serve a higher purpose, to recognize the pattern, solve the puzzle, unlock the secret, deconstruct, and change the game. Quote, "I'm always at war with luck and disorder," McGrill says in that SI story. "I'm always trying to impose my will over the randomness of the dice, over what seemingly has no structure. I may be sounding sort of melodramatic, but what I'm trying to do in backgammon is create order out of chaos."
Thank you, Stefan Fatsis. And that is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. This week, I would like to endorse Slate's parenting podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Every week, Gabe Roth, Rebecca Lavoie, and Carvel Wallace discuss all aspects of parenting from toddler to teens. They answer listener questions, share their own parenting triumphs and fails, and talk through parenting issues in the news. Get it every Thursday wherever you find your podcasts. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, who before Brooke Lopez did it last week, was the last center to score more than 25 points in a game with no rebounds, having done so in 1967. Congrats, Zelmo, and thanks for listening.